Indeed, for as long as I can remember, Godzilla's been a part of my life.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with William Satsui, former president of Hendrix College and self-admitted aficionado of all things Godzilla.
Teasing out the charm of Godzilla is no easy matter. For in our embrace of the beast are entangled strands of nostalgia, the mysteries of childhood, the phantoms of nuclear war, the hard-nosed business of movie making, the unresolved tensions of world history.
Godzilla Monomore, William Satsui, and well over 50 years of the King of Monsters. On Arts and Letters. From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with William Satsui, former president of Hendrix College in Arkansas, and author of Godzilla on My Mind, 50 Years of the King of Monsters.
Seems like just yesterday I would run into the neighborhood Piggly Wiggly looking for the latest issue of Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, hoping that a new article on Godzilla would appear. In so many ways, Godzilla remains a compelling, dynamic presence in American culture, an icon adored and derided, cheered and jeered, yet never, unlike so many of the elite cultural canon of our society, forgotten, ignored, or benignly neglected.
William Satsui's book, Godzilla on My Mind, 50 Years of the King of Monsters, published by St. Martin's Griffin, recovers Godzilla from B-movie status and imagines what part of the King of Monsters is a reflection of the technological dilemmas mankind has put himself in.
This book is an attempt to understand why we Americans enjoy, respond to, and in some cases love, a half-century-old Japanese movie monster. And how so many people all around the world, from all demographics and across all dividing lines of age, sex, and race, come to relate to Godzilla. Understanding the appeal of Godzilla, when all is said and done, means understanding ourselves.
William Satsui, teacher, historian, in whose office Godzilla is forever welcomed. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I liked what you said when you said it's an attempt to understand why we respond to, enjoy, and love a half-century-old movie monster, and how many people across all demographics, dividing lines, age, sex, and race come to relate to Godzilla. Why do you think that is? Why is it such a popular franchise?
There's something about Godzilla, that big, strong character, that hero of the movie screen, that dependable force, in many ways for good, but also a reminder of the weaknesses and mistakes of mankind, that has hit a nerve in global society. It, of course, originally was made for Japanese audiences, but today I think it's more popular in America than anywhere else.
In one part in the book, you say science makes and unmakes us. And I'm interested in teasing out not the science, but the concept of science in this. And it seems that so many of the movies were kind of timed with events that occurred, particularly the first movie, Gojira, in 1954. And then the U.S. had just exploded that major mega bomb over the Bikini Atoll. And then in 1984, with the Three Mile Island incident, and those two were the highest grossing of the movies. Was timing some of it?
Timing was definitely part of it. And the movie makers were very aware of this. They were trying to make relevant films that talked to the concerns of audiences at the time. That first Godzilla, of course, appeared during the height of the Cold War, when audiences in Japan, but elsewhere, were just constantly living under this cloud of nuclear holocaust. What I like about the Godzilla movies is that in them, they really address the ways in which science can cut two ways. Science can be liberating and empower mankind, but science can also be threatening and hold the promise of destroying mankind as well. And it's on that knife edge, I think, that audiences can appreciate the thrills of Godzilla.
But good Japanese science and bad American science.
That's one of the funny things about it. That original movie really demonizes the United States. When America discovered the power of the atom during the war, they used it against people in Japan. But when the Japanese, in the fictional retelling of that first movie, find an even more powerful super weapon, they decide only to use it to kill the monster and very carefully protect it from human misappropriation.
So what do you make of just this strange concept of a radioactive dinosaur essentially reappearing and then tramping on mankind, but at the same time audiences cheering for that?
You know, one of the things I think explains the long-term appeal of Godzilla is that kids, no matter where they are, love dinosaurs. There is something appealing about these huge monsters that were once real, and that we can imagine a world in which perhaps they could live again. It's like Jurassic Park. We all want to buy into this fantasy that the monsters could come back.
Okay, so give us a little picture. I'm imagining it's about 1972, and young William wants to be Godzilla. Well, you're 9 years old. Tell us about you and Godzilla and the Godzilla suit.
Well, I'll tell you about the first time I saw Godzilla. I must have been 7 or 8 years old. I was lying on my stomach on the blue shag carpeting in my parents' bedroom in Bryan, Texas, on a Saturday afternoon, watching the Creature double feature from Channel 39 out of Houston.
Godzilla, King of the Monsters, alive, surging up from the depths of the sea on a tidal wave of terror to wreak vengeance on mankind. Godzilla, King of the Monsters, it's alive!
And I remember seeing the monster come on the screen, and I recall my original thought was, I want to be Godzilla. I want to drag my big scaly feet through Tokyo. I want to swat fighter jets out of the sky. I want to make chemical plants explode. So for me, Godzilla was an immediately appealing character. Godzilla, though, also helped me understand the Japanese part of my identity. I'm Japanese-American. And in Bryan, Texas, at that time, we had two Japanese-American families. So there wasn't a lot for me to hold on to in terms of that Japanese heritage. But folks at school knew who Godzilla was, thought Godzilla was pretty neat. And so I embraced that and used that to shape that part of my identity. I can vividly remember the thrill of building Aurora's plastic model kit of Godzilla, standing amid the rubble of Tokyo, swinging his glow-in-the-dark hands as if frozen in the middle of a square dance, polymer teeth flashing and eyes glinting. Maybe it was just the plastic cement fumes working on the soft gray matter of a preteen, but that little model, $1.79 plus tax, sent chills up and down my spine.
So one Halloween, you decide to take the plunge to become Godzilla.
So I couldn't really transform myself literally into a 10-story mutant lizard, but I set my heart on the next best thing, becoming Godzilla for Halloween. So I whined and pouted to my mother. She was never much for sewing, but she was reluctantly enlisted in the project. The construction of that costume really was an epic undertaking. A virtual Manhattan Project of chartreuse rayon, foam, rubber, and mild cursing. A pair of white gloves that were veterans of many long ago church socials were extorted from my grandmother, and they were dyed green. I can't quite remember now how my feet were disguised, but I think I might well have been the only Godzilla in history to have worn hush puppies. The pièce de résistance, however, was my snout. A tin teacup, which we got down at Woolworth's on North Main Street, hung between my eyes underneath the green fabric.
There's this picture in the book And you are adorable in this picture. Do you remember when this picture was taken? I'm sure you do.
I do. I had just put on the costume. I was so happy. I had a model Japanese jet in my hands. I went out in front of the house, and my father took the snapshots.
All right, so tell us about the big night, the unveiling of your hallowed Halloween costume.
I went to Davy Crockett Elementary School, if you can believe that name. And the annual fun fair was in the evening. It wasn't easy getting there because Hollywood didn't think to design cars that could easily accommodate dorsal fins and a sizable lizard tail. At school, though, my bubble really burst. My third grade classmates and their parents either didn't know who Godzilla was or couldn't recognize what a 4-foot-tall light green sack of rayon with a very odd nose was meant to represent. My mother's labor received scarcely a compliment. When I roared, the kids just laughed and the adults looked bemused. The biggest insult to my pride, however, occurred in the haunted house. In between the bowls of human eyes and the mummy rearing up from his cardboard casket, someone, and to this day, I think I know exactly who it was, had the temerity to step on Godzilla's tail, ripping the stitching and revealing that giant movie monsters prefer reefs to boxers.
Is this the end of our civilization? You may wish to deny it, but your eyes tell you it's true. A tale to stun the mind.
Man, what a sad story.
Oh, I stormed outside to my waiting parents and demanded to be taken home immediately. My tail, quite literally, between my legs.
A story beyond your wildest dreams.
Dynamic violence.
Savage action.
Spectacular thrills.
Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
I announced to my parents that there would be no trick-or-treating that year. And after that ill-fated October 31st in 1972, I never dressed as Godzilla again.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with William Satsui about his book, Godzilla on My Mind, 50 Years of the King of Monsters.
We'll be back in a moment. This is Arts and Letters. Let's return to our discussion with William Satsui about his book, Godzilla on My Mind. At 11, you go to Japan during the summer with your parents.
What happens?
So this was my first trip ever to Japan. And when we were there, we went to visit one of my father's high school classmates who'd gone on to own a small department store in Chiba near Tokyo. While he and my father were reminiscing in the executive suite, one of the store's employees, and I can remember him still today, he spoke almost no English. And his suit was about as shiny as a freshly polished car. He was assigned to take me down to the toy floor and allow me to pick out anything I wanted as a gift. Can you imagine, you know, being a kid and having that opportunity? In my mind were dancing these images of giant radio-controlled sports cars, huge plastic model kits. We went down, we got to the sixth floor, and I headed straight for the back counter, because that's generally where they kept the most expensive and elaborate toys. But before I made it back there to what I thought I wanted, I saw something else just out of the corner of my eye on a table. There on a display was Godzilla. 12 gorgeous inches of richly painted tin,
cha-ching,
with row upon row of plastic fins and a cord sprouting from a unmentionable place right at the base of his tail. It was a remote control Godzilla that walked, after a fashion, opened and closed its jaws, and howled in this kind of grating metallic kind of way. This to me was a fantasy. Better than a puppy, better than a swimming pool, better than a week's excuse from PE class. The guy asked me, "Are you sure you want this? Because it is honestly one of the cheapest things in the toy department." I couldn't have been happier, though. When I walked back into the department store owner's office, clutching that Godzilla tin toy under my arms, the relief on my parents' faces was obvious. No apologies, no scenes, no discipline were necessary. I had shown incredible politeness, dignity, and restraint, and obviously had demonstrated that my parents had done a great job raising me as a polite young man. But in all honesty, manners had nothing to do with it. That day, that tin growling Godzilla toy was my very deepest desire. So never, I think, in the history of childhood has such blatant self-interest been rewarded so generously. And I'll never stop thanking Godzilla for that.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with William Satsui about his book, Godzilla on My Mind.
So in a sense, Godzilla's misunderstood, isn't he?
Completely. You know, Godzilla is one complex guy. And there's so many questions we have about Godzilla that we don't have a good answer to. Why, for example, does this monster come out of the ocean time after time and want to destroy Tokyo? What is it that drives that logic? And why is he so angry? You know, where does that hostility come from?
And he has become personified, not as much in the first film, but it's become a personified character that we can cheer for.
Definitely. I think that's what actually sets Godzilla apart from many other cinematic monsters, perhaps not from Frankenstein or Dracula in that classic tradition of being very human monsters. But if you compare Godzilla to a lot of the monsters that have come out of Hollywood, Godzilla clearly has a character. Godzilla might even have a soul. And that is something distinctive about Japanese movie making and that Japanese tradition of giant monsters.
And I'd say the closest would be King Kong.
Definitely.
With also a look and a soul.
That's right. You know, King Kong is very much the same story of a creature that is plucked out of his natural environment against his will by humans and then rages against that treatment.
So is Godzilla a boy or a girl?
Well, I am not ashamed to say that I have absolutely no skill in sexing lizards. And the costume is about as revealing as a Ken doll. There's no detail there. Love was in blind when I saw you. I knew my way around. And the grass was growing extra tall for me. And I had your number in my head. What makes it confusing is, back in the 1960s, Godzilla had a son hatched from an egg on Monster Island that nobody really knew where it came from. The American Godzilla film made in 1998, the TriStar Matthew Broderick version, definitely casts Godzilla as a female who descends on New York City and lays a whole mess of eggs in Madison Square Garden. But to me, you know, Godzilla will always be a guy. He's got that kind of attitude. He has that kind of anger and rage and power that to me makes him a he. And yeah. Like many fans, I call him the big guy.
Yeah, you call him the big guy. Which Godzilla movie had the greatest impact on you?
You know, for me, I always go back to the original, 1954. The first movie in the series, undoubtedly, I think, a classic of world cinema today, but in many ways so different from the rest of the series. It was a very dark movie, a very somber movie, a movie with a very clear political message and an agenda. Made for adults, not for kids, none of the goofy, playful Godzilla of the 1960s or 1970s, not really the high-tech special effects Godzilla that we've seen in more recent years, but a Godzilla that addressed some deep human fears and some anxieties of the time.
Right, so this is the 1954 film Gojira, and you talk about it in your book as a kind of horror film. And by horror, you mean it kind of exemplifies the horrors that have happened in Japan. What's the state of the world in 1954, and why does this capture the imagination of the Japanese and the Americans?
You know, Godzilla was very much ripped from the headlines back in the 1950s. Of course, that was less than a decade after the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, so those memories were still extremely raw for the Japanese people. But an event in March of 1954 really set the stage for the film. It's become known as the Lucky Dragon Incident, which was the name of a fishing boat that had strayed accidentally into the U.S. atomic bomb testing range at Bikini Atoll in the South Pacific. From bad luck and bad planning on the American side, the explosion they ended up putting off the first H-bomb was much, much stronger than anyone imagined. The crew of that ship was irradiated. Many of them suffered radiation poisoning. The tuna from the ship, which was toxic, made it onto the market in Japan. And this became a huge international incident. It was front page news all over Japan. The media called it the latest atomic bombing of Japan. At the time, the United States denied all nuclear tests. They said the sailors had died of food poisoning. And for many in Japan, it really brought home that the horrors of nuclear holocaust were close at hand. Gojira is very much rooted in a particular time and place, Japan in the 1950s, just a decade after the atomic attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in the midst of the Cold War. But it's also timeless and placeless, a story of human arrogance and human vulnerability, of our collective fear of the unknown. Classic's a really overused word in the vocabulary of film critics, yet this label really applies to the dark, brooding, and still profoundly compelling 1954 film, Gojira.
Tell us about the creature's origins. I know it's kind of a mythic story, right?
The story goes that the producer who created Gojira was flying home to Japan after making a film in Southeast Asia, and he was looking out at the wide expanse of the South Pacific Ocean. And he thought about classic Hollywood giant monster films, things like King Kong.
Why, in a few months, we'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
The real story of the ocean depths begins where you left off. Wonders that defy my powers of description.
And he thought about the Lucky Dragon incident, the issues surrounding that. And he had one of those great light bulb moments. What if there was a dinosaur who'd been living under the seas, irradiated by American H-bomb testing, that set its sights on Tokyo and attacked the capital? He went back and started making his film. And really, it just followed that simple narrative. In the movie, it starts with some unknown force destroying ships and terrorizing a small island south of Japan. The Japanese government dispatches a party made up of scientists to explore this phenomenon. And what they find is that a dinosaur that had been lurking in the depths of the ocean had been awakened by American nuclear tests and now was wreaking havoc. The monster then decides to head north for Tokyo, and in a series of really amazingly made nighttime raids, lays waste to the city. Happily, though, for the Japanese, there's a mad scientist who's been working on a new super weapon, a device called the Oxygen Destroyer. And he is persuaded to use this weapon against Godzilla. So when the monster is napping by day at the bottom of Tokyo Bay, the scientist and another man descend with the oxygen destroyer. They place it by Godzilla, and the monster is killed. But what's interesting is, in this story, the mad scientist ends up killing himself too, because he is so concerned that the super weapon, the oxygen destroyer, not fall into the hands of either side in the Cold War and be used against human beings. After 1945, the Japanese wanted to forget the war. There, of course, weren't parades for people coming home. There weren't the commemorations of the lost souls. And to the people who made this film, in some ways, Godzilla represented that forgotten, buried past that couldn't stay hidden forever. When asked years later, the creators of the film, the director, the composer who wrote the soundtrack and so forth, offered an idea, at least, to fans of the series. Godzilla, they suggested, represented the souls of the Japanese soldiers who had died in World War II in the South Pacific and were now coming home. And they demanded recognition from the Japanese people.
Let's just talk about the production.
Yep. So the director was a guy named Honda Ishiro. At the end of the war, Honda was in the Japanese army. He was stationed in China. And at the end of the war, the American military brought many Japanese soldiers from abroad home through Hiroshima so they could see how thoroughly defeated and how powerful America was. So that was a life-changing experience for Honda to see the devastation of Hiroshima. It made him a committed, lifelong pacifist. And he was dedicated to making Godzilla a strong statement movie.
And this movie made an awful lot of money in Japan, but it wasn't really released to American audiences in its original form. It was recut with, if we remember, Ironside or Perry Mason. Raymond Burr is the lead character, and he narrates it.
A prehistoric monster the Japanese call Godzilla has just walked out of Tokyo Bay. He's as tall as a 30-story building.
It takes on a strangely American perspective. But yet that movie made a lot of money, both in Japan and in America.
Exactly.
What's your take on the recutting?
Well, you know, Godzilla, the original Godzilla was a blockbuster in Japan. It set a record at the box office in Tokyo for a weekend new film release. But the filmmakers immediately recognized that it had huge export potential. People in Hollywood were interested, but they faced a real dilemma. How are we going to introduce this to American audiences? And they felt they really had two options. One was to put subtitles on it.
Mm-hmm.
But they realized that a lot of kids would want to go see a giant monster film, and kids don't love the subtitles so much. So it wouldn't really work, they thought, as an art house piece. The other option was to dub it, to put English language voiceover across the Japanese original. But of course, that was cheesy and seemed cheap. And they thought it was too good a movie to do that. So they did something really creative. They decided to extensively edit the Japanese film, shoot new scenes, and insert Raymond Burr as an American reporter who narrates the events in Tokyo.
Now he's making his way toward the city's main line of defense. 300,000 volts of electricity strung around the city is a barrier. A barrier against Godzilla.
Raymond Burr was about the cheapest talent they could afford for this movie, who had any box office appeal. He shot all of his scenes within 24 hours on a soundstage in the San Fernando Valley.
Down here in one little studio on Western Avenue, the smallest studio in this town. And we shot all of that movie, everything that I was in that movie, in a 24-hour period.
And the work was actually extremely clever. If you watch the American release called Godzilla, King of the Monsters, that came out in 1956, it's hard not to be impressed with what they accomplished. That being said, one of the things that happened in that re-editing was that 20 minutes of the original Japanese film were left on the cutting room floor. And in retrospect, what they took out were all of the most politically provocative, engaging, and frankly, anti-American parts of the original movie.
A prehistoric monster the Japanese call Godzilla has just walked out of Tokyo Bay. He's as tall as a 30-story building.
Those original filmmakers had wanted to make a serious political message, a pacifist message during the Cold War.
The tanks have been wiped out by a wall of flames.
And the distributors in Hollywood didn't think that would play in middle America. So they took out criticism of Washington, they took out the strong memories of World War II, and they made, in many ways, even though it's a very clever adaptation, one that's not true to the spirit of the original.
Neither man nor his machines are able to stop this creature.
Although the Japanese government wishfully announced in 1956 that the post-war period is now over, the Japan of the mid-1950s still bore the scars, both physical and emotional, of total war and defeat. Japanese cities were still rebuilding from wartime firebombings, families remained broken and grieving, and a complex sense of loss, lost lives, lost dreams, lost war, tormented many of the survivors. Japan was still a very poor recovering nation in 1954 when Gojira was made, and it was a very vulnerable place, economically and above all politically, caught between the United States and the USSR in the Cold War. With no power in the world, the Japanese people felt like victims, just as they had during the war, when American firebombs and, of course, two atomic bombs fell on them. Godzilla tapped into this profound sense of powerlessness in the face of vast destructive forces beyond anyone's control.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with William Satsui about his book, Godzilla, King of the Monsters. We'll be back in a moment. Let's return to our conversation with William Satsui as we talk about Godzilla on My Mind and the mythology of the monster in Japan and its evolution throughout the 60s, 70s, until today.
Some of this is grounded in archetypal Japanese folklore.
There are some roots. A lot of fans believe that Godzilla is a mythical Japanese monster. There isn't exactly a mythological equivalent in Japan of Godzilla. There are a lot of dragons. There are a lot of creatures that live in the depths of the oceans. But Godzilla is very much like Japanese demons in the sense that he is threatening and yet also protective. And this definitely comes out in the Godzilla series.
And it plays up on some of the Japanese fears of a vulnerability.
You know, Japan is really in nature's crosshairs. Just about any natural calamity that can occur takes place in Japan. Earthquakes, volcanoes, tidal waves, typhoons. And Godzilla is very much part of these waves of disasters that fall upon the Japanese islands. Japan, as geologists, geographers, and meteorologists will attest, lies directly in the crosshairs of almost every destructive power that Mother Nature can launch. The natives of the Japanese islands have always had to endure the unpredictable assaults of earthquakes on volcanoes, typhoons and tidal waves, floods and landslides. Fire has also been another ever-present natural enemy, especially in those dense, wood-built, readily inflammable cities of Japan. The Japanese have an old proverb, Jishin Kaminari Kaji Oyaji, that lists the four most fearsome things in the world: earthquake, thunder, fire, and father.
Why father?
Japanese society is deeply patriarchal, and the image of the gruff, overbearing, uncompromising, Godzilla-like father figure is really deeply embedded in Japanese culture.
Tell us about the suit. So I imagine in the original, they might have imagined a kind of claymation or who knows, you know, or illustration, but they decide to put a guy in a suit.
You know, the state of the art back in the 1950s in terms of special effects was claymation, but it was incredibly expensive. To have to shoot still by still an entire film would simply have been prohibitive in Japan at that time. So they did the next best thing, a man in a rubber suit walking through miniature cities. The suit was quite a piece of engineering. It was incredibly heavy. It weighed over 200 pounds. It was made out of rubber. To keep it rigid, it had pieces of wire in it and bamboo stays. And it was incredibly uncomfortable for the actor who had to operate within it. During the takes with those bright cameras on him, it was said that he would sweat out a quart of liquid during every scene.
And he was a stuntman.
He
had to be tough to
exactly.
be in that suit.
You know, the actor who played Godzilla in the first 12 movies in the series was named Nakajima Haruo. And he was chosen for the role for two reasons. One, he was a very determined individual, so they knew he'd be able to carry it off. The second was, he actually fit inside the suit. He was small and wiry. And he took the role extremely seriously. This was a big break for him. So to study up how to play Godzilla, he went to the Tokyo Zoo to study the animals. And he initially thought that he would get his inspiration from other lizards, so he looked very carefully at the alligators and crocodiles. But he found that alligators aren't very expressive. They just lie there most of the day. And it was really the bears that gave him inspiration. And I think if you go back now and look at those early Godzilla movies, you can see the way in which a bear moved was what Nakajima recreated.
And what's really amazing, at least to me, are these miniature sets that they make so painstakingly and to scale. They had a huge crew making these things.
The special effects director for the Godzilla films was a guy named Tsuburaya Eiji, and he was a genius. He cut his teeth during the war making propaganda films for the Japanese armed forces. He made a famous one that recreated the Battle of Pearl Harbor using miniatures. And it was said that when the American forces captured a copy of this movie, they initially thought it was actual newsreel footage because it looked so realistic. After the war, he turned his talents to monster pictures. And making those miniature cities is incredibly painstaking and labor-intensive. But Japan in the 1950s had nothing if it didn't have lots of cheap labor. And so they spent untold hours making these detailed models. Inside and out, they were detailed. The buildings weren't just facades. But when Godzilla stepped on a building, you needed to see all the offices or apartments explode as well. And they were very clever about using materials. So at one point in the movie, a famous scene, Godzilla uses his radioactive breath to melt electric towers. And what they did was make those towers out of wax and then turn a heat gun on them so it looked like they were being melted by Godzilla's breath.
He even gets in trouble with the law.
One day before they started shooting the film, Tsuburaya and his assistants were in downtown Tokyo scouting out the path of destruction the monster was going to take through the city. And he went up to the roof of one of the department stores in the fashionable Ginza district. And a police officer happened to overhear the men talking, and he thought they were sketching out a terrorist plot for attacking Tokyo. He managed to talk his way out of that, but it shows how realistic the monster's attack was.
And how seriously they were taking it.
Exactly.
The music. Tell us about the music. It's gorgeous.
The music is amazing. It remains one of the defining features of the Godzilla films. What is incredible in retrospect is how quickly that soundtrack was made. Just 1 week. From composition to recording. The composer was a guy named Ifukube Akira, and he was a distinguished Japanese classical composer. He did a lot of work with movies. He also worked with the Japanese military during World War II, and one of his jobs was composing new national anthems for all the countries that Japan conquered in East Asia. So he made the Burmese national anthem and the Thai national anthem and so forth. He really did something amazing with the Godzilla score, though, I think, that captures the majesty and the power of the monster, but also some of the terror and the fear that everyone felt when they saw that creature and heard those resonant footsteps.
And they knew they had to get the roar right, too.
The roar is really Godzilla's trademark.
Right.
Because if you hear that sound, you know the monster's in the room. They took a lot of work to get that. They initially thought that they could use some sort of animal sound. but everything they tried didn't sound quite right. And so ultimately, Ifukube, the composer, came up with a very elegant solution. They took a leather glove, which had been coated with some resin to make it a bit sticky, and they dragged it across the strings of a double bass. They then took that sound and fed it through a reverb machine, so you really get that strong, deep, powerful echo. And it captures that majesty and the power of the monster just beautifully.
Arts and Letters, we're talking with William Satsui about his book, Godzilla on My Mind, 50 Years of the King of Monsters.
Here's motion picture adventure and excitement to stagger the imagination. The fantastic fire monsters raging out of the flaming bowels of hell. Mighty Gigantus crushing whole cities in its wrath. And deadly Anguirus, screaming its challenge of mortal combat. The battle of the ages. Scenes and sights and sensations beyond anything the screen has ever shown.
We'll just go back to the second film, which does well too. Mm-hmm. And it's called Godzilla Raids Again. And then begins a series. Could you help kind of recapitulate just what happened to Godzilla after the first 1954 movie?
So the 1954 Gojira is a big hit. Almost immediately a sequel comes out called Godzilla Raids Again in 1955. But then the Japanese start exploring other monsters, and that's the age when many of those creatures that we're also familiar with, like Rodan and Mothra, first make their appearances. Godzilla only returns as really the main star of the Japanese monster movie industry in the early 1960s. And Godzilla films are churned out from the 60s through the early 1970s on an annual basis.
In one of the most explosive action pictures ever to hit the screen, from the depths of the ocean comes the most terrifying horror of the deep. Will Godzilla, man's friend, be vanquished?
While Kong is a thinking animal, his brain is considerably larger, about 10 times the size of this gorilla's skull.
Tell us about when they had Godzilla fighting other monsters. Godzilla versus King Kong was one. Mothra was
Godzilla
another.
Godzilla versus King Kong is really a classic movie. And that was one of the highest budget Godzilla films in the 1960s. They were thrilled to be able to get the rights to King Kong from Hollywood. And for our eyes now, it wasn't a great job. The King Kong costume in particular is pretty terrible. It's sort of a mangy-looking ape. But the legend all along has been there were two endings made for that film. One ending for American audiences in which King Kong won, and one for Japanese audiences in which Godzilla won. The truth of the matter, there was only one ending, and it's a draw. At the end, they're wrestling, and they fall off a cliff into the Pacific Ocean, and they each swim off in different directions. And the reason for that was simple. Toho wanted to make a sequel, and they wanted to leave both monsters ready to fight again.
Godzilla fans would be upset if we don't talk about Mothra.
Now, a new ally stands to battle the menace of Godzilla.
Over there!
The gigantic insect known as Mothra.
Mothra is really one of the classic monsters, and market research has always shown that Mothra is particularly popular among women. And so when the studio wanted to attract more women into the theaters, they put Mothra in the movies. Mothra is a giant moth, and I've asked entomologists what kind of moth Mothra is. Mothra is a silkworm. moth, which is very appropriate to Japan. And so Godzilla is recast from a villain to being more of a hero. And Godzilla in the 1960s and 70s most often is defending Japan against other creatures, either from outer space.
I'm controller of planet X.
Or cooked up by evil undersea civilizations. Or wherever. Godzilla becomes more or less a mascot for Japan.
So this is not the sinister, homicidal, black and white, fresh from the Bikini Atoll.
You know, what's interesting, though, is even when Godzilla becomes more kiddie fair in the 1960s, the filmmakers still want to treat serious issues in Japanese society. So they deal with issues like government corruption, big business and its influence, and the growth of a consumer society. Not things you'd usually think of as being addressed in children's films, but they get some serious airing in the Godzilla movies.
Environmentalism?
Definitely. By the early 1970s, I mean, Japan is more or less like we think of China today. It's almost becoming unlivable due to the pollution. And the Godzilla movies take it on straight. Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster is one of my favorites in the series.
Out of the polluted waters it came, to become the most fearful menace that ever threatened mankind. Feeding, growing ever more deadly on smog. Only one force dared stand up to its overpowering evil.
Godzilla!
It is psychedelic and crazy and one of the lowest budget movies you'll ever want to watch, but it treats the issue of environmental degradation with a kind of frankness that few Japanese movies were at that time.
And the suit remains.
The suit is always there. And to me, that's really what sets Japanese monster movie making apart. Having a guy in a rubber suit makes Japanese monster films special. You know, I love Hollywood high-tech computerized animation as much as anyone does. It makes for exciting, realistic films. But I think that audiences, and especially kids who are so many of the people watching Godzilla movies, are able to relate to the monster so much better because they can see it's essentially human in form. It moves like us. I could be that monster.
Up from the depths, 30 stories high.
We talked about the 60s to some degree. What about the 70s?
The 70s continue in the tradition of the 60s, but in the mid-70s, the series really runs out of steam. The box office is getting smaller and smaller. The creativity of the films is declining. And so the decision is made to give Godzilla a pink slip. For a decade, Godzilla goes away from the mid-70s to the mid-1980s. But so many kids in Japan grew up with the monster that there's a lot of demand and a lot of pressure on the studio to bring Godzilla back. So in 1985, Godzilla roars back to life, and for another decade, a new series of films is made. These films are more serious. They have better special effects in general. They take on timely issues of those days. That's a time when the Japanese economy was just booming. And Godzilla, at that time, becomes sort of a conscience for an increasingly wealthy, arrogant Japan. Japan thinks it can do anything and be anything, and the filmmakers tried to show through Godzilla that, you know, that wealth and that power can be very fleeting when a giant lizard comes stomping through Tokyo.
So you'd want to make Godzilla our pet?
No. We would be his.
More than 60 years after the first film, Godzilla continues to speak to audiences, which is a testament to the ability of a radioactive reptilian character to change with the times and remain relevant in a very fast-changing and fickle media environment.
And you write that he transcends human understanding. He doesn't just break rules of modern science, but he transcends our world.
That's why Godzilla is so endlessly fascinating. If we could understand him, if we could tie him up neat with a bow, he wouldn't be a character we keep coming back to decade after decade, film after film.
Bye.
wants to love like Godzilla, like fire, like fire. All I want is all the love I desire, I desire.
When I was growing up, the members of my family could see eye to eye only on a very short list of things. Godzilla was not a subject on which we shared much common ground. My father attended a few Godzilla matinees with me, but usually only under duress. My mother was sympathetic, but even on those nights when she allowed me to stay up and watch monsters on the Late Late Show, she could usually only take about 10 minutes of dubbing and suitmation before falling asleep on the sofa.
Terrorizing my horizons every day, I'm deprived of you. Top of the empire we have made, you and me, babe.
My school friends were never all that keen on Godzilla either. And my grandmother probably took the dimmest view of all. For Nana, Godzilla films were instruments of the devil. My point is not that I was persecuted for my love of Godzilla, or that my friends and family were unenlightened louts. Instead, I simply want to emphasize that different people invariably see the same thing in a multiplicity of different ways. And therein lies the rub for anyone foolhardy enough to try analyzing America's ongoing romance with Godzilla.
Monster love like Godzilla, like fire, like fire.
When I watch a Godzilla movie, I don't see a man in a rubber suit dragging his feet through cities and executing perfect hammerlocks on monstrous opponents. I see my youth. I see days gone by. I see a world that was small and simple and no scarier than the average creature feature on late night TV. The King of the Monsters is not just a motion picture superstar, not just a reliable old friend, but is also a cherished keepsake of a personal past. An evocative memento of childhood, a powerful emblem of nostalgia for an age, and perhaps also a childhood now lost.
It takes the breath right out of town when I can't find a route to heal it, heal it, heal it.
But I don't think it's completely lost. It's always living on. He'll be here long beyond us, I think.
Thank goodness, I too think Godzilla is forever.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock. You've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Thank you to musicians and songwriters. Okie dokie.
Love was in blind when I saw you.
New motto. In future elevators. A special thanks to Grace Askew for her song, Monster Love.
Monster love like Godzilla, like fire.
A big roar to Donovan Suit for the mashup music and special effects. Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for mastering the episode. Thank you to Four Points by Sheridan, Midtown Little Rock, for supplying rooms to guests of Arts and Letters. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to Professor Godzilla, Bill Satsui, for taking us on this journey through Godzilla's universe and his commentary on the politic, the environment, and the very roar of the King of Monsters. For Arts and Letters, let's heed these words from 2019's Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
This is Godzilla's world. We just live in it.
Damn right.